Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And you know, Ken, it's a little known fact that Marilyn Monroe sang that song, Happy Birthday, Mr. President, to Richard Nixon. Not to John F. Kennedy, as was widely believed at the time since he was present, but actually to Richard M. Nixon. And you know why we're bringing that up this week?
Because this happened to have been Richard Nixon's 100th birthday this week.
This very week.
Yes.
This very week.
Yes.
Just before we recorded this podcast, you and I, of course, were celebrating the memory of our dearest president.
And, you know, Gerald Ford, who would have turned 100 this July, pardoned him again.
Wherever they are.
Yeah, they're pardoning.
They're pardoning.
And hopefully this podcast will get a pardon, which is very unlikely.
It's extremely unlikely. Speaking of presidents, we have one now, and he has a new cabinet forming. In fact, we are building a new cabinet as we speak.
At the same time, we have an old cabinet leaving.
We do.
We have Hillary Clinton.
She's going.
Leaving, and then we'll have John Kerry confirmed.
That's correct.
We have Leon Panetta leaving as Secretary of Defense.
He is definitely going away to California to his walnut trees.
The time has come for me to return to my wife Sylvia, our three sons, their families, our six grandchildren, and my walnut farm. Dealing with a different set of nuts.
Of course, President Obama hopes that Chuck Hagel will be replacing Leon Panetta. Now, I understand that Chuck Hagel could very well be confirmed, but I don't think he could get bar mitzvahed.
All right. Chuck Hagel has got a little bit of problem with some members of Congress.
Yes.
Mostly Republicans, not entirely Republicans, but many Republicans feel he is insufficiently supportive of the state of Israel.
That's right.
And insufficiently hostile, or shall we say tough, when it comes to the state of Iran.
Yes, and there's also the James Hormel nomination in 1998, the openly gay. And while some gay leaders are saying, okay, all is forgiven because he has apologized for that, that has come out again. Log cabin Republicans have said this is still unacceptable.
Log cabin Republicans being the gay
the
organization
gay Republican, right.
Within the Republican Party.
Right. Look, Chuck Hagel is not an anti-Semite. He's not pro-Iran.
He's probably not anti-gay at this point,
no,
although he probably was at least to some degree critical of gay people in public life.
He was aggressively anti-gay.
And in the 1990s.
But what I really think it is, I think it's personal. I really think it's personal. Just like with Susan Rice, I think senators just did not like her, not because of Benghazi or anything else. I think it's personal.
All right, but wait a minute. This is a guy who was a senator. 12 years he served in the Senate as a Republican from Nebraska.
Right.
He's a self-made millionaire in the cell phone business.
Right.
Here's what the president had to say in introducing him.
To this day, Chuck bears the scars and the shrapnel from battles he fought in our name. Chuck Hagel's leadership of our military would be historic. He'd be the first person of enlisted rank to serve as Secretary of Defense, one of the few secretaries who've been wounded in war, and the first Vietnam veteran to lead the department.
By all accounts, he has a tremendously impressive resume, but I think it goes down to hurt feelings. When he was a senator, many of his dealings with his colleagues was my way or not, that I'm smarter than you, and that's the way it is. Of course, he did endorse Barack Obama over John McCain in 2008. Chuck Hagel also endorsed Bob Kerry in Nebraska over Deb Fischer, the Republican who ultimately won the 2012 election.
So there's another really good
friend
in the current
Senate. There are bad feelings among many Republicans. Is it enough to block? I don't think so. Is it enough to defeat the nomination? Who knows? But I don't think it's really all about Israel and Hamas and Hezbollah and James Hormel. I think a lot of it is personal.
All right. So you've got three or four or five different factors here. And you've actually got some small group of Democrats who are not terribly happy about him because, aside from Israel and Iran, they would just rather have a Democratic figure in the cabinet, in the Secretary of Defense slot. And so there's that little group. So you've got maybe four or five different categories of people with some sort of problem. And even though they overlap a bit, if you took all of those together, would they be enough not just to have a vote against him, say 30 or 40 votes against him, but to actually stop the nomination via filibuster?
Well, then the other question is whether the filibuster, and that has not been decided yet in the Senate, but of course Harry Reid talked about, and many Democrats have said, look, Senate is not working. You could filibuster the Pledge of Allegiance. It's just
that's part of the problem with the degree to which Congress has become so partisan and so divided that they do block everything either party wants to do. When you get to the point of somebody really getting tough on enforcing the rules, and you say, well, if you do that, you're going to spoil the atmosphere.
Right.
It's a little hard to imagine how it gets worse. But here's one question I think a lot of people have about the filibuster. Whether you think it's every senator's right, whether you think that it protects states' rights or protects the minority, whatever you think about it, why not just make them do it for real on the floor? We've all seen Mr. Smith goes to Washington. We've all seen other fictional representations of the filibuster in action.
Fictional people like Strom Thurmond, who stood up for 24 hours filibustering this 1957 civil rights bill, which is the record. So, yes, I mean, if you're going to make any kind of change in the filibuster, make the senator stand up, and if you want to hold up the Senate, do it in person.
Get a bunch of them and make it real, and then the country can see who's doing it.
Right
now, they do it largely in secret. They just put a secret hold on something and say, I might filibuster, so don't bring that to the floor,
and then
they don't.
Right, or since we don't have 60 votes, therefore it's a filibuster, but of course it's not. It's just cowardice, and that's what goes on.
That's right, and a lot of just plain cowardice gets excused in the name of the filibuster. So if we could just see them do it for real, I know it's embarrassing to them, but that's kind of the point. Let them embarrass themselves and let us know what it is they're willing to embarrass themselves to stop.
Going back to the cabinet for one more second, I know a lot of newspapers and bloggers have talked about this, but for an administration who is very aware of diversity, it is kind of interesting that given the fact that when you think of the people who are leaving the administration, Hillary Clinton, Hilda Solis as Labor Secretary, Lisa Jackson as EPA, of course, Susan Rice will stay in the administration. And then the new folks who are coming, the John Kerrys, the Chuck Hagels, the Jack Lews, they're all white male.
And John Brennan as the CIA's director. And John Brennan is really a particularly white male, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, he's like the national daddy. He's the guy who's very serious and very mean and never takes off his tie and coat, as the president was kidding him about. It's like he's the guy in charge of telling you how bad the world really is and defending you against the worst of that world.
My only point is not to criticize the president about the diversity.
I wouldn't do that.
I mean, he has a better record than George W. Bush, perhaps the same as Bill Clinton. It's just that looking at the photos and the pictures,
it's bad optics. The initial pictures of the cabinet, kind of bad optics.
All.
We're going to have to see where this goes and what influence that has on some of the other picks that he's going to make from here on out. And let's just note that in this past week, the Secretary of State, whom you mentioned, is leaving that office, but is still in that office pending the confirmation of John Kerry, came back to work after three pretty rocky weeks where she apparently reportedly had a fall, had a dizzy spell coming from a stomach virus.
Concussion?
Had a fall, had a concussion, had a blood clot on her head between her skull and her brain. And all of these things can be pretty serious. I think a lot of people are a little worried about her health, especially considering how hard she's been working and what she might be thinking about doing 4 years from now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. She did not say that she's retiring or resigning. I think she said she alluded to an interlude or
taking a step off the fast track.
Exactly.
And she's been on that fast track for quite a while.
She looks tired. She may very well be tired, but I hate to once again lead this Hillary conversation to 2016, but it is what everybody's thinking
2016 about. Would be the next year of a presidential cycle.
Right.
Okay.
Another person, of course, who figures very prominently in 2016 is the current vice president, Joe Biden. And Joe Biden also figures very prominently in the news this week when it comes to guns.
Yes. You know, the week before that, he negotiated the solution for the moment to the fiscal dilemma or conundrum or cliff or whatever you want to call it.
He solved the NHL lockdown.
Easy for you to say.
Right.
And then he came to the subject of guns. Can Joe Biden find the sweet spot where America can do something to reduce gun violence without violating the rights under the Second Amendment that are so important to so many Americans, including you, Ken? I know that.
Look, I always liked a man of your caliber. But my thought is that no, he can't. And the reason I think no, he can't is, yes, this week he met with a representative of the NRA and Walmart, which sells a lot of guns. And
which is almost as big as the NRA.
Well, in many ways, regarding guns, it is. And they're trying to obviously come to some kind of a consensus. But one, I don't think a consensus is possible. And two, when we think of the tragedy and the horror of Newtown in the immediate days right after that tragedy, we did hear Democrats saying maybe it's time for another kind of thinking, another way of thinking on guns. But we also had Heidi Heitkamp, the new Democratic senator from North Dakota, just elected. The Democrats were very excited about this election, who talked about we don't want to have these evil gun laws. And for there to be a sea change in Washington, first, I think we have to have a more gutsy definitive statement by pro-gun Democrats, and that's not happening. We know where the Chuck Schumers and the Dianne Feinsteins are. We know where the very conservative Republicans are. But those Democrats in the middle have to make a move, and I don't see that happening.
Let me just say, too, that this is not, strictly speaking, a Democrats and Republicans kind of conflict. As much as it is conflict for those two groups, it's also a conflict between regions, between cities versus rural areas. It really divides the country in a lot of different ways, but it really divides the country. So if Joe Biden or anyone else can devise some kind of a means by which people can reach some kind of policy change that makes everyone feel better, that will be a miracle indeed, even greater than perhaps solving the NHL strike.
And that's why it's interesting to see what's going on in the states. And in Wednesday's State of the State message, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo really talked about a far more restrictive...
Stunning.
Considering the fact that New York has one of the most restrictive gun laws in the country, this was going well beyond that. A lot of progressives have said on many issues, Cuomo has not been outspoken enough. On guns, he certainly was outspoken.
It's simple. No one hunts with an assault rifle. No one needs 10 bullets to kill a deer. And too many innocent people have died already. And the madness now. Pass safe, reasonable gun control in the state of New York. Make this state safer!
One other development this week, we have, in a sense, a new first couple in the fight against guns, or if you will, the fight to control guns in the society. Gabby Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, former astronaut. Gabby Giffords, of course, is the congresswoman who was shot just 2 years ago.
To the day.
To the day that they came out with this new group that they're forming, a little bit like the Bradys, who were the face of gun control back in the 1990s after Jim Brady was gunned down in the attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan in 1981.
And Gabby Giffords said, look, this is not a violation of the Second Amendment. We believe in the Second Amendment. In fact, we have handguns locked up in our home in Arizona. So it's not about that, but it's about mental health issues. They're talking about background checks, things like that.
Okay. And in political news, we have campaigns coming up. And we also have 2013 appointments to talk about. We talked a lot about the appointment to the Senate in Hawaii. And we've got an appointment coming up in Massachusetts to replace John Kerry, as we all assume he'll be confirmed for Secretary of State.
Well, there are two processes in Massachusetts. One, there will be a special election. But just like with the death of Ted Kennedy, when Governor Deval Patrick named Paul Kirk as an interim senator.
Just for a few months.
Right. Hence the term interim. Governor Patrick will name a short-term senator. They're looking for somebody who's about 4 feet tall.
No, they're looking for somebody who can, you know, bring some dignity to the position of being an interim senator. And so, of course,
the first name that comes to your mind.
Immediately, when you think of dignity, you think of Barney Frank.
And sometimes you wonder why Barney Frank would really want this job.
A month ago, and a few weeks ago, in fact, I said I wasn't interested. It was kind of like you're about to graduate, and they said you got to go to summer school. But that deal now means that February, March, and April are going to be among the most important months in American financial.
So you'd consider it?
I'm not going to be coy. It's not anything I've ever been good at. I've told the governor that I would now like, frankly, to do that because I would like to be a part of that. It's only a 3-month period. I wouldn't want to do anything more. I don't want to run again. Right.
So that's Barney Frank and Joe Scarborough trying to get a word in edgewise. Joe Scarborough is pretty good at getting a word in, and yet, with Barney Frank, he has a hard time.
No, everybody does. But, of course, by most accounts, there are several other people who have lobbied the governor for that short-term appointment. We don't know if it'll be Barney Frank, but we do know that groups like MoveOn.org are among those who have come out for the Barney Frank appointment. Also, you wonder why Barney Frank wants to rejoin Congress. There was a public policy polling poll that just came out. Now, of course, they're talking about the 112th Congress.
The last Congress.
Right. But they say that Congress is now less popular than root canals, NFL replacement referees.
Cockroaches.
Head lice, the rock band Nickelback.
Wow. The rock band Nickelback?
Yeah. Colonoscopies, carnies, traffic jams, cockroaches, Donald Trump, France, Genghis Khan, a used car salesman, and Brussels sprouts.
Okay, I don't think it was fair throwing in Donald Trump. I really don't. That was a low blow.
The good news is Congress did beat out telemarketers John Edwards, the Kardashians, lobbyists, North Korea, the Ebola virus, Lindsay Lohan, Fidel Castro, playground bullies, meth labs, communism, and gonorrhea. Other 2014 news, in Ohio, Ted Strickland, the former governor, will not seek a rematch with John Kasich, who beat him in 2010.
I think that's probably a smart political move on the part
he's in
of
his 70s.
The former governor. He's in his 70s. I mean, he's a very vital guy, and there's no question that...
Great speech at the convention.
Yes, he gave a huge siege gun of a speech at the convention, and there's no question that he has the physical capability of running again in the 70s, but you know, John Kasich, while he may not be the most popular governor in the country, he's probably going to have a pretty good year in 2014.
His numbers are going up.
His numbers are going back up, and it's a midterm election late in a presidency of a Democratic president. Ohio will probably be in a more Republican mood next year, and Ted Strickland doesn't really want to lose to this guy twice. If he's going to have a political comeback, he'll wait a little longer.
Another senator to watch in 2014, and I'm sure Ashley Judd is watching him as well, but Mitch McConnell, for all the kudos directed at Mitch McConnell for the fiscal cliff deal, not every conservative is excited about this.
No, and put it mildly.
And there are some on the right who are talking about a challenge to him in the 2014 primary.
That's great, and that would probably be one of the most closely watched primaries that Kentucky's had in a very long time.
And remember, his fellow Republican from Kentucky, Rand Paul, voted against that fiscal cliff deal.
That's right. And Rand Paul is, of course, interested in supporting somebody else other than Mitch McConnell, as Mitch McConnell supported somebody else other than Rand Paul in his own primary.
I don't think they forgot. Either one has forgotten that.
No, memories tend to be longer than just about anything else in the United States Senate.
And speaking of memories, and I hate to, once again, we end a podcast with a sad note, but this guy, Richard Ben Cramer, if you're a political junkie or if you have any interest in politics at all, What It Takes, the book about the 1988, it's not even about the process. It's about the people.
It's the lives.
The human beings who run for president. Richard Ben Cramer wrote about these candidates, the Bob Doles, the Dick Gephardts, the
Joe Bidens.
The Joe Bidens, the Gary Harts, mm-hmm. all those people. In 1988, the book was a phenomenal book.
Unfortunately, it was not a big success. It didn't come out until 1992. It was nearly 1,000 pages long. It was a little, I think, overwhelming for a lot of people. They didn't know what to expect. And it wasn't a Washington book. In fact, it doesn't even have an index.
You know, I love that story. I remember that at the time because I was at a big book party and I suggested to Richard that I said maybe we should have a separate party for the index. Because the thing that's so endemic about Washington is that the first thing you do when you get a book about politics, everybody goes to the index to look for their name. And Richard Ben Cramer, to his amazing credit, although it
probably hurt the book,
but he refused to have an index in the book. And I think he did that because he was an impish kind of guy.
He was
a lot of fun. He had other great books about Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams. He loved baseball. But this book, What It Takes, is really something to read. It really captures the humanity of these candidates, which many of us often ignore.
It was a monument to political writing, a very different kind of political writing. And it's a shame it didn't get a bigger audience at the time, but it has since been recognized as a classic, and I think it'll be around for a long time. Pity we can't say the same for Richard Ben Cramer himself. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw. I'm Ken Rudin. And a quick note of personal privilege. This Wednesday, January 16th, at the historic 6th and I Synagogue in Washington, D.C., there will be a Political Junkie Roadshow, 7 p.m. You can still get tickets if you go to npr.org.
And you can also join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Cucaracha, la cucaracha, ya no puede caminar, porque le falta, porque no tiene marihuana que fumar. La cucaracha, ya no puede caminar, porque le falta, porque no tiene marihuana que fumar. Una guacamaya pinta, le dijo una colorada.